This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts. This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube and now also on Bloomberg Quick Take.
Well, a most read story today on the Bloomberg. In fact, several of the most read stories in the Bloomberg today are again about the crumbling empire of Sam Bankman-Fried. One in particular, though, Tim, is about the lawyers for the now bankrupt firm FTX and concerns about its founder. It's a legal angle to this story.
You might remember yesterday afternoon, we got some headlines on the Bloomberg terminal. They said that FTX was coming out and saying that Sam Bankman-Fried has no ongoing role at FTX, and he does not speak on behalf of FTX, FTX US, or Alameda. And I made the comment that if you're a bankruptcy attorney handling this bankruptcy, you probably don't want to see him tweeting the way that he's been tweeting. And it turns out that's actually the case. We got Stephen Church with us. He's bankruptcy reporter for Bloomberg News. He joins us via Zoom from our Wilmington, Delaware bureau. Stephen, we're getting some insight into what the lawyers for FTX, the case that they're making and what they're coming out and saying in terms of the mess that they have to clean up right now. What did we learn this morning?
We learned the main thing was that the lawyers believe that there was a huge mess that was unprecedented in terms of its corporate controls.
Hold on. When you say unprecedented, you mean unprecedented. I mean, we're talking Enron, WorldCom. Are we talking here? Like going all the way back?
Let's look at it this way. Enron was probably one of the worst corporate fraud scandals in U.S. history, among the worst. The man who was charged with cleaning that up is now the CEO of FTX, and he says it's the worst thing he's ever seen.
So, Stephen, is it unprecedented in terms of lack of controls or non-existent controls?
I think it'd be unprecedented in terms of the weak or, and in some cases, non-existent controls is what he's arguing. The main thing that happened, two big things happened this morning. They filed two important court documents. One laid out the case for why they're in court, what the problem is, and how they hope to solve it, although they didn't have much detail on how they hope. The other thing they did was unusual. They asked the judge in Delaware to prevent the regulators in Bahamas from taking control of the case in any way.
So does that mean that it ensures that it will be handled in U.S. bankruptcy court?
No, it'll be split. The way these cases typically work is you have a giant conglomerate you have a giant business that touches all corners of the planet. That's the way this one is. Usually the different courts work together. They get a protocol together and they agree on how to handle creditors, how to handle lawsuits. We're at the beginning stages of this. The Bahamas case is smaller than the U.S. case in terms of the entities that are covered by it. So we're just at the beginning of it. Most likely, the U.S. court here in Delaware will take the lead on that. The lawyers in charge of that case have been complaining about the way the former CEO has handled himself the last few days.
Are we going to see him on the stand?
Unlikely. I doubt if he will appear in the stand in the bankruptcy case. He would obviously be a hostile witness at that point because the lawyers are fighting with him about mm-hmm. some of the things that he's been saying. More likely, you'll see the current CEO, the man who was in charge of Enron a few years ago, take the witness stand mm-hmm. if necessary over the next few weeks.
Hey, Stephen, what happens to SBF? What could happen to SBF? That's the question everybody wants answered.
Well, we know that in Manhattan, the U.S. Attorney's Office there is investigating the company. I got to believe that they will look at him specifically. So he may face at least a criminal investigation. There's no telling whether or not he'll be charged. Obviously, it's way too early. But there's also an investigation in the Bahamas that's going forward as well. So one of the things that in the bankruptcy court is very likely to happen is the creditors will turn their sights on him and say, what money have you got? Give it to us. You caused the problem. That's pretty routine in big cases where you have a scandal involving the CEO.
Yeah, it's so fascinating. You know, I think about this, Stephen, because, you know, initially, I feel like in the earlier days of crypto, we talked about the ability to avoid regulators and the law enforcement. We know subsequent to that, that there are ways to track it all down, despite what we thought was a lack of transparency. But will there be some difficulties in maybe understanding the relationships among all the entities under FTX and in SBF's empire? Or does law enforcement, the lawyers feel like they're going to be able to uncover a lot?
I would not bet against all of the forces arrayed against SBF right now. These are very good lawyers and experienced investigators on both the Bahamian side and in the U.S. side. So they will probably be able to unravel much of it. Now, whether or not there are certain black boxes they can never get their hands on, that's possible. But I would guess that they'll be able to lay blame where they think it should be, and they'll bring actions in court. Remember, creditors lost a lot of money, and so it's in many of those creditors' interest to find cash that is hidden or lies in an asset somewhere. So there's a lot of money backing the lawyers who are trying to get back much of the money that was lost.
When you say much, just in the last 30 seconds that we have with you, it's hard to estimate this and see the future, of course, Stephen. I would never ask you to do that. But what's a realistic expectation that customers could have?
Oh, I it's way too early for me to talk about that. Obviously, billions are at stake in this case. We don't even know how much money that regulators and the lawyers can get their hands on. We don't know how much money will roll into the bankruptcy court that the bankruptcy court can then distribute. The lawyers said in their court papers,
right,
they are collecting hundreds of millions of dollars, or they think they've identified hundreds of millions of dollars.
Right. All right. Well, we so appreciate your reporting. Stephen Church, bankruptcy reporter at Bloomberg News on Zoom from our Wilmington, Delaware Bureau. You're listening and watching Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
The world continues to include COVID, which we know in some parts of the world, such as China, really continue to be a drag on economic growth and getting back to a more normal way of life. I will say, Tim, it does feel like in New York City, as I was coming up in the World Trade Center, I mean, there were a lot of people coming off the trains this morning. It does feel more back to normal.
Yeah, especially on a Thursday. Friday, we'll see if that's another story.
It does get quieter.
Yeah, it does get a little quieter. Hey, let's get into it and talk all things pandemic and other respiratory viruses as well. We've got Dr. Koser Talat joining us, Associate Professor of International Health at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. The Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health is supported by Michael R. Bloomberg, founder of Bloomberg LP and Bloomberg Philanthropies. Dr. Talat joins us on the phone from Baltimore this afternoon. Dr. Talat, good to have you back with us. I want to start with this idea of what I talked about just in the tease that right there, this idea of a triple-demic right now. I don't know about you, but I did not hear about RSV overwhelming hospitals, especially in pediatric areas, until this year. What's different about this year?
Well, we haven't heard it quite so bad either. What's different about this year, there's a couple of things. The first is this RSV season is much earlier than we usually see it. Usually RSV is a wintertime virus. We see it filling up pediatric hospitals in January and February, not in October and November. So it's much earlier. And in addition, there's many more cases. RSV season has been altered because of COVID. So when we were all staying home and when we were all wearing masks and kids were not going to school, RSV really disappeared for for the better part of two winters. Last year, we had a big RSV surge in the summer, and then it went away in the fall, which was really unusual. And this year, it started in the fall, and it's much, much higher. And part of the reason why it's so high is because so many people have not seen RSV in several years. Our immunity has waned. We have cohorts, like large numbers of babies young children who've never had it. So now everybody's getting it all at the same time.
Yeah, it's scary stuff. My cousin has a 3-year-old who was in the hospital for 5 days with RSV, who thankfully is okay right now.
Yeah.
Dr. Talat, so what are we to do as parents? What are we to do as we head to the holiday season? Recommendations?
Well, if you're sick, stay home. If your child is sick, keep them home from school. If they're old enough to be wearing masks, this might be a good time to be wearing a mask. Unfortunately, we don't have vaccines for RSV yet, but hopefully we'll have at least adult RSV vaccines in the next few years. Wash your hands, all the good public health things that we've been told for many years during cold and flu season.
Dr. Talat, just got about a couple of minutes left here. So now we've got 4 vaccines, COVID-19 vaccines, just switching gears here, that are available in the U.S. We've got the Pfizer, BioNTech, and then the Moderna, which are messenger RNA vaccines. You've got Novavax COVID-19 vaccine. It's a protein subunit vaccine. And then you've got J&J's Janssen vaccine, a viral vector vaccine, and can be given in some situations. A really nice listener is messaging us, and his name is Michael, and he's saying, I'm wondering if Novavax is as effective as the other vaccines for COVID.
The Novavax vaccine was evaluated and seen to be very effective at preventing severe disease, hospitalizations, and deaths, just like the other vaccines. Currently, the Novavax booster is just it's the single strain, whereas the mRNA vaccines are now being given as 2 strains, the bivalent vaccine that is targeting the Omicron strains. But Novavax does work very well, and if you prefer to get a more traditional vaccine, the Novavax vaccine could be a good fit for you. If you want the bivalent vaccine to get the best Omicron protection, then the mRNA vaccines might be a good fit.
Well, in just 30 seconds, because I took, I've been Pfizer all the way, and I took the 5th vaccine and felt like I had COVID for 24 hours. He's also asking, just to follow, is there less of a chance for side effects or milder side effects? And just got about 30 seconds from the Novavax. Yeah,
the side effects may be a little bit milder, yes, because but the side effects generally are very short lived, no matter what vaccine you get, and are a small price to pay for being protected against COVID.
Totally agree. For me, it was like 24 hours, and I kind of bounced back. We thank you, Michael, our viewer, listener. Thanks you as well. Dr. Kosar Talat, Associate Professor of International Health at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. And as we remind you, it is supported by Michael R. Bloomberg, founder of Bloomberg LP and Bloomberg Philanthropies. She was joining us on the phone from Baltimore.
When cyber criminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education, by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
As travelers get ready, like Tim, to take to the air as the holiday season gets underway, our Alan Levin in the new issue of Bloomberg Business Week takes a look at the glamorous air charter market, the dark corners of that market, that is. This story, by the way, also the Bloomberg Big Take.
Implying that I'm going to fly on a private jet somewhere for between $40,000 and $70,000 for a round trip between the East Coast and the West Coast?
Whatever works for you, Tim Stenovic. Right.
I'm not going to be doing that. And especially after reading this story, I think it raises a lot of questions about what the charter industry looks like. We've got Joel Weber, the editor of Bloomberg Business Week, with us in the Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio, and also Alan Levin, aviation safety and FAA reporter for Bloomberg News. He joins us on the phone from our Washington, D.C. bureau. Joel, I want to kick it over to you and just make a distinction at the beginning of the conversation about how we define illicit charter flights. Because the definition is, it's kind of murky, right?
And that's why I think the story is scary, right? Like, I think people are getting on planes that they assume are fine, and in the worst case scenarios, as Alan's reporting shows, learning in disastrous ways that they're not. And it is murky, and that's I'll let Alan actually take the question in terms of like illuminating the very specific question that you have. But the bigger thing to me is just, I think there are private aviation has become almost sort of this shadow world that is very attractive. You can get places far easier, and all you need is a little bit more money than flying via a normal one. And it has Alan's reporting here reveals that it comes with a host of problems and worries. Alan?
Yeah, that's correct. And, you know, in our world today, we can you assume when you get an, if you call an Uber or you get in a taxi, that it's sort of been vetted by the government. It's not perfect, but at least, you know, they're looking at it. And I think that assumption carries over into the charter world, not least, you know, at least in part, it's due to the fact that there are lots of apps you can get that will get you a charter flight. And so people just assume it's the same thing, but unless you know what you're doing, it's really hard to tell the legitimate operators from the ones who are not licensed and, you know, in some cases are really cutting corners on safety.
I'm sorry, I'm just having like FTX flashbacks.
I was just gonna say, in a world like, of like
regulators and accountability. Like, okay, it works here, accountability. You assume that because it has a fancy app that it, you know, and that it has ads, that it's going to be okay.
Right.
So this is really interesting. Exactly. There's this part in the piece, Alan, and you have just some, you know, really heart-wrenching examples. Marcy Wilhelm is somebody you spoke to for the piece. Tell us about her experience flying privately.
Yeah, let me just start by saying I've been covering air crashes for a couple decades now, and this is really one of the most heart-wrenching ones. Marcy was amazing, had an amazing success story. She had co-founded a healthcare company, and they'd sold it for almost $200 million. This was back in 2018. She'd been hired to be the CEO of the successor company, and you know, she had was going away on a long weekend to Nantucket with some friends from her house in Florida. They stopped in South Carolina to pick up some folks, and the plane essentially did not have brakes, and it's a fairly big corporate jet with high speeds compared to some other planes, and it just went screaming off the end of the runway down an embankment and broke into pieces. It killed both pilots, and Marcy and her husband were both severely injured. And what investigators came to learn very quickly was that the plane never should have been in service on many different levels. For one thing, Marcy booked the flight on a legitimate charter operator, but they're required to have, you know, put each and every aircraft on their certification. This aircraft was not. But beyond that, it had dozens of maintenance items that weren't complete, and most notably the brakes. And the most stunning thing of all is a mechanic had noticed that the brakes weren't working, had put a bright orange placard, kind of a sticky note, if you will, on the brake panel right in front of the pilot's faces that said inoperable. So technically, it said inop, which is whatever, you know, that's what everyone in aviation know. I mean, they should know what that means. And they still landed without the brakes and had this accident.
How is this happening still in the year of our Lord 2022? Like, how and why? What are the blind spots here?
So, you know, in the legitimate air charter world, I don't want to leave listeners confused. In the legitimate world, there is a ton of FAA oversight. It's not perfect. Occasionally we see flaws, but, you know, they're required to do everything from pilot training to drug testing employees, on and on and on. But there's, you know, a good 20,000 or so private jets that are privately owned in the U.S. And, you know, let's say you're a business and you bought this jet and suddenly the costs of maintenance are adding up. You might say, well, geez, why don't we just rent it out, you know, to somebody? And if you do that, you're not following all those safety measures that the legitimate guys do. And from the outside of the plane, it's almost impossible to tell the difference.
And I guess I'm just wondering, why does it all fall through, you know, the hands of regulators or the FAA ultimately? But I can see where the cracks are. So what's your advice to folks out there who might be interested in chartering?
Well, it turns out the FAA, partly in a reaction to this a few years ago, began publishing a list of all the aircraft that are legitimately licensed to carry people for hire. So you can look that up. You have to go to, if you Google FAA air charter safety, you'll find a link to it. There's a trade group that has been very involved in this as well. And there are also several private companies that do auditing of charter companies, sort of save the customer the hassle of doing that. And so there are definitely ways to figure out who's legit and who's not.
And we teased earlier that there's a connection between Jamie Foxx and
Governor Whitmer,
Hollywood producer, Peter Gruber, also the NBA and I think the NHL. So highly recommend that you check out this story in the upcoming issue of Bloomberg Business Week, also on the Bloomberg Terminal and at Bloomberg.com, because it's a really important one and a lot of detail there from Alan Levin, our aviation safety and FAA reporter. Alan, thank you.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Alex Barranca, technology reporter at Bloomberg News. She's got a great story in the new double issue of Bloomberg Business Week dealing with Meta platforms. Alex is with us via Zoom in LA. So, Alex, good to have you here. Tell us about your story.
Yeah, so we've heard a lot of kind of anger at the general economic conditions from all of the internet companies like Meta that depend on digital ads, blaming the economy for the really bad quarters they've had over the last 6 months or so. This week in Business Week, I'm writing that there might be kind of a bigger reason that Meta in particular's ad business, it has a big hole in it, and that hole is shaped like Apple. About a year ago, Apple changed its privacy policies for the iPhone that made ads on social media both harder to target specific people and harder to track the return on the spend on those ads. And a year in, Meta has estimated that that's had a $10 billion hit on its ad business. And, you know, myself and a lot of the analysts and insiders I spoke to for this story would also argue that that's what's dragging Meta down to potentially its third straight quarter of revenue declines. It's more Apple than the economy. Mm. And I tried to break that down for folks this week.
Well, there's a stark chart included in your piece that shows how other companies are faring or projected to fare between 2021 and 2022. TikTok, according to eMarketer, has a projected change of 155% versus Meta down at the bottom of a projected change of negative 2%. Why is TikTok able to capitalize on something when, you know, they're using the same hardware and the same operating systems to deliver those ads?
I think there's two key reasons. So Meta, as you mentioned, Facebook, Instagram, those are Meta's companies, have historically been based on who you know. Your friend graph is how they derive kind of insights on you. And plus the information that they were able to glean from Apple to make sure that advertisers are reaching the people they want to reach. TikTok, on the other hand, has built out an AI kind of focused recommendation engine that is derived on a user's interests. So they know more about you than just who you know. They know who you're actually interested in. That is some of the information. It's not quite apples to apples that Meta has lost. So TikTok has been able to kind of really lean into this interest-based recommendations. That idea, interest-based recommendations, is also where Meta is spending a lot of money to kind of chase into that. Now, the one caveat I would give is Meta is still an advertising giant. They're still expected to bring in about $116 billion in revenue this year. TikTok is only about a tenth of that. So there is some kind of youth in growth there for TikTok. But that is kind of the big reason that folks might be looking to platforms where they can target people a little bit more effectively than maybe what's been lost on Facebook and Instagram.
I got to say, Alex, one of the lines I love in your story, you say the company has no experience managing decline. There's something to be said. I mean, this is a company that has been on fire, maybe a little bit of a, you know, trouble at that IPO initially, but figured it out, righted the ship. But when things start to go wrong, like, you might not have a playbook or the people in place to be like, well, wait, how do we fix this?
Right. And you remember just last week, they laid off 13% of the workforce in their biggest layoff ever. So this is a company now that's going to be expected to do more with less. So this Apple thing is a big problem, but there are a lot of other problems at Meta. You have the economic conditions. You have the scrutiny on the political power that Facebook and Instagram have on the world. You have this big bet that Mark Zuckerberg is making, trying to build a virtual reality world called the Metaverse and funneling $10 billion a year into that direction. So there's a lot going on there, and now it's going on with 11,000 people fewer than just 2 weeks ago. So it seems like they're really going to have to kind of buckle down. We've heard internally that, you know, there's still some restructuring going on, that, you know, this is the first time that a lot of employees are being pushed to a level of efficiency and leanness than they ever have before. So this will definitely be one to watch as they kind of juggle both coming back from these changes that Apple forced upon their business, battling economic conditions, and trying to paint the future of computing in the metaverse.
Hey, Alex, I kind of want to throw a little bit of a curveball at you because it's, you know, not necessarily what your most recent piece is about, but I know you've done so much reporting about this. I'm wondering what small businesses think of this change, because they're the ones who have done a lot of advertising historically on Meta platforms, including Facebook and Instagram. And now, ostensibly, it's more difficult for them to target their potential customers.
Yep, throw those curveballs away. I will say big businesses have been okay. They've spent more on like newspapers or buying ads on TV channels. So the big companies can do that because they have the budgets. Small businesses have kind of historically been stuck with two options with basically Meta or Google Alphabet's search ads when it comes to reaching customers on the internet. So they've been the folks who basically have had to kind of go roll with the punches here. And that's also why we think there's been such a big decline in overall ad spending. Those are the folks that kind of have to pull back because they can't write, say, a $500,000 check to advertise on something like Hulu. They're kind of stuck reaching customers on the internet, and it's gotten a lot more expensive because the targeting is less effective. So those folks are the ones that are probably impacting it the biggest from a pure quantity perspective. That's the majority of Meta's advertisers. So small businesses also, you know, are probably looking to places like TikTok and other properties where they can spend the small budgets they have to find the customers that they want.
Alex Pirinka, really appreciate it.
When cyber criminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, we have just about 10 minutes left in today's trading session. Bouncing around here on the equity trade. Same story when it comes to the yield trade. I think as investors go from Fed conversation to Fed conversation. Right now, in terms of stocks specifically, as Charlie mentioned, definitely off our lows of the session. And we're seeing a leg up, Tim, here in our final minutes of trading.
We are, but volume is really low right now. The S&P down, volume down 20%.
I think people are already starting to think about that. Thanksgiving holiday. Well,
that's what I want to ask Charlie Massimo all about. He's Senior Vice President and Financial Advisor at the Wealth Enhancement Group on the phone from Blue Point, New York. Charlie, good to have you back with us. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks. Thanks for having me as always.
Yeah. Hey, so what are investors waiting for? Why are they on the sidelines?
I think the Fed's confusing the heck out of everybody with comments and there's a lack of conviction.
Us.
Yeah. I think there's just a lack of conviction on which way we want to go. And I think people are just waiting for the next data point to make a decision on where they want to put their money.
Well, where would you want to put your money right now if you had to put some new money to work?
I think there is so many positive things happening in the market right now, despite what we read in the headlines. And, you know, you have inflation, which is coming down without seeing any deterioration in the labor market, which is a really positive indication and something the Fed is certainly going to pay attention to. I think you have S&P 500 companies they're so flush with cash, which means that we probably will see increase in dividends coming along. So I'm a huge proponent of value stocks that are going to show increased dividends and really going to pay people to wait while we see a real turnaround in the market.
Can you name any specific value stocks that you have your eye on right now?
Yeah, again, I think when you see any stocks like Target that are beat up, these are great companies, right? And when you can buy a company 20 to 30% cheaper than where they were just a year ago, you have to take advantage of it. Because, again, I think in a year, 2 years from today, these companies are going to be significantly higher. And again, I've always said this. This is not when you become shy of investing in the market. This is when you become very aggressive and buy some of these great American companies.
So it raises the question about whether or not you think we have further losses ahead of us. Like, is there going to be a better time to get into the market maybe in the first half of 2023?
Well, listen. You can always debate when is the right time, and I think as an individual investor, you have to see where you are in your own time frame. But again, you know, when these companies, we spoke probably about 2 months ago when the market was about 10% lower than where it is today. So again, was that a good time to invest? Did we hit bottom? You know, I think when you look at the market, it's much more positive and much more constructive now, meaning the lows are much better than what we've seen a year ago and a week ago or 2 weeks ago, and the highs are pretty significant on up days. So I think we're starting to see a market that is trying to find direction, but the direction is much more positive than negative right now.
Yeah, it is kind of, it's so funny. I was just looking at the home builders, the home building index, which is certainly a laggard in today's market. It's down about 2% if you look at the S&P Super Composite Home Building Index. But, you know, it's been bouncing around a lot. And I understand the housing data feels like it's a little bit more to the downside. But the group is still up 15% since October 20th. I always feel like there's mixed signals in this market. So, Charlie, what do you most monitor for getting an idea of maybe where valuations should be and where the market will ultimately go? Because it does sound like you have some optimism for the trade in 2023.
Yeah, not only 2023 and certainly beyond. I mean, when you think about some of the staggering numbers, you know, I was just reading today that the Brookings Institution projects that between 2020 and 2030, about 1.6 billion people will enter the middle class. I mean, that's significant. So you think as they enter the middle class and these great companies that will continue to prosper from this growth in our economy and in our world. So it's really not one specific place that I'm looking. I'm just looking as a general, as a market as a whole, that as we continue to see these numbers improve, there's just an amazing opportunity for the companies across the board, really, to see increased values at a significant clip.
Okay, so, Charlie, I want to go back to Fed speakers because we talk about them a lot here, of course, and we try to dissect all of their comments. And I'm wondering if you take everyone who you've heard from over the last few days or so, the message that you're seeing, is it one that's broadly showing that we're going to see an easing of rate hikes come December and the early part of 2023, or is it one that says there's still more work to do?
Well, I think over the short term, there's probably still more work to do. And that's not because of inflation not slowing or slowing down, because we are, but I think it's really the Fed that's trying to be overly aggressive in this market. You know, what he's done already, and I agree with what he's been doing, because again, a short-term bear market is much worse than long-term inflation for this economy. So I agree with what he's doing, but I think now it's time to let all these raises seep into the market and slow down. So what I'd love to see him say is that we may have more work to go, but we're going to slow down the pace and we're going to wait to see that make that our increases in yields are really helping the inflation slow down. That's what I'm hoping he says. I don't know if he'll say that, but I think that would be a huge positive indication for the market.
You know, Charlie, we've talked about this before with you, because you and what you do at your firm, you specialize in planning for families impacted by autism. And, you know, these are families that really have to make sure that they've got investments in place. So I do think in an environment where we feel like things keep coming at us left and right, longer term, you know, what do you see as the best bets?
Yeah, again, it's a really great point. And I think that you have to take a deep breath as an investor and really measure where you are from a risk tolerance standpoint. You know, in the past few years, it was great to own technology, but now you have some of those companies down 30 to 70%.
Yeah.
So you've lost 3 to 5 years of growth in 1 year or in less than 1 year.
Does that ever come back?
It will, but it's going to lag the rest of the market.
Like, so is it going to look like the dot-com bust of the late 90s, early 2000s and take a decade?
I mean, I don't think it's bad, because some of these companies have real earnings versus dot-com, where they had no earnings at all. So I think we have companies like Amazon that are having a difficult time that will still show some significant earnings moving forward. But I do think, again, getting back to the point of Carol, you have to look at the market and say, hey, where am I going to get the steadiest growth, not get the big ups and downs? And I
right.
think the steady growth is being broad-based, not overweighting in any industry and
right.
sector. And again, I know value is out of favor, but again, over
okay.
time, value would be more the more consistent play.
All right. Well, Charlie, thank you so much. Have a good Thanksgiving. Charlie Massimo, Senior VP, Financial Advisor at Wealth Enhancement Group, on the phone from Blue Point, New York.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, or watch us live on YouTube and now also on Bloomberg Quick Take.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.